This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Organization experts meet Chinese officials at the start of their mission to investigate the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. A row between the EU and the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca deepens as Germany declines to recommend the firm's COVID vaccine for older people. Also coming up, the head of the US Capitol Police says permanent fencing is needed around the Capitol following the January 6th attack there. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, experts from the World Health Organization are in China to investigate the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. The team is now in the city of Wuhan, where the virus first emerged in December 2019. The WHO experts have already begun meetings with Chinese officials and scientists. China has warned against political interference in the mission. That came after the US expressed concern over what it called misinformation from some sources in China. The US has previously accused China of creating the pandemic, with former President Donald Trump calling COVID-19 a Chinese virus. Trump also accused the WHO of being a puppet of China. Stephen Rebay is our correspondent in the Chinese capital, Beijing, and he joins us now. Stephen, welcome. What's the latest on the WHO mission there?
Well, in tweets, the WHO has said the team has requested detailed underlying data. They plan to speak to early responders and some of the first COVID-19 patients. They didn't give any further details of the team's agenda, although they have said in earlier tweets that they plan to visit hospitals and markets like the Hunan seafood market that was linked to many of the first cases, along with the Wuhan Institute of Virology and laboratories and facilities like the Wuhan Center for Disease Control. They have tweeted that all hypotheses are on the table, meaning they're open-minded about this. They're not going to be guided by any prejudice or any preconceptions. But they have an arduous task ahead. It's possible they may never find the truth or three reasons. The first is that it's very hard to confirm the origins of a virus in an outbreak like this. Nearly everybody agrees it came from bats originally, but to trace the original reservoir where those bats came from will require taking animal samples, genetic analyses, and epidemiological studies. It's a very, very nitty-gritty, long, and arduous process, as I said. The second reason is that the Chinese understandably will want to avoid a result that makes China look bad. So, of course, they have an incentive to restrict access, to guide the fact finders to achieve a result that favors them. However, this is the third reason. They are also concerned, as they have said time and time again, that the US now has its own agenda, and that agenda is to blame China in order to muster global opinion against China. China is now paranoid that America is out to bring it down, to stop its rise, to reverse its achievements, and will use every possible means to further this agenda. And it's also very mindful that the US and its agencies, including, for example, the CIA, are very adept at manipulating this kind of fact-finding mission to their own ends. That sounds laughable to people who don't know how America works, but I don't think it's too much of a stretch to compare this fact-finding investigation to, for example, another fact-finding investigation, which was UN weapons inspectors in Iraq and indeed Iran, who should be neutral and sticking to what they're supposed to do, but instead, in the case of Iraq at least, were manipulated and pushed to a further an American agenda for regime overthrow. So if China believes America is out to get it, then of course it's going to be very cautious and restrict access, err on the side of caution, and of course that's going to benefit nobody, but it is what it is, that's the reality.
Right. Stephen, thank you very much indeed for that. Stephen Rebay there, our correspondent from the Chinese capital, Beijing. Now, Europe's row with the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca has worsened after Germany declined to recommend the firm's coronavirus vaccine for older people. Germany's Vaccine Commission has cited a lack of enough data to assess the vaccine efficacy among those over 65. That has added fuel to the row already running between the European Union and AstraZeneca. They've been at odds over the company's failure to deliver jabs to the block. AstraZeneca has said it can only supply a quarter of the doses it has promised for the first quarter of 2021. The EU has asked the drug maker to divert jabs from its UK-based plants. The United States faces new challenges as the country registers its first two cases of the more contagious COVID-19 variant, first discovered in South Africa. Health authorities say there is no travel history or connection between the two cases that were found in the state of South Carolina. Several lab studies have shown the South African variant reduces vaccine effectiveness and requires higher doses of antibody for treatment. Also, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called for a rapid rollout of COVID-19 vaccines to limit the virus mutation. The developments come as the country's healthcare system is already stretched to the limit. The U.S. is the hardest hit country globally by the pandemic. Its cumulative cases have surpassed 25.7 million, while total fatalities topped 432,000. So, in the U.S., Joe Biden has been established as the president, but he inherits what may be the worst economy in a century. Key new data is showing the depth of America's historic economic despair, and also revealing how poverty, unemployment, and inequality continue to soar. Ramima Zahari reports from Chicago.
The terrible economic data just keeps on coming for the United States during the coronavirus era. A new study found the yearly increase in the poverty rate was the highest in 60 years. At least 8 million people were added to the poverty rolls in 2020. Fresh weekly unemployment data saw the number of jobless claims reach their highest in 4 months. The weekly joblessness disaster provoked the mainstream media Politico to publish an article which calculated what they called the true unemployment rate. When the underemployed and working poor are included, unemployment is over 25% in the richest country in the world. Fourth quarter economic growth data just came in under expectations at only a 4% increase. That's especially dismal considering it only had to improve on a record 33% plunge in the third quarter. 2020 saw widespread political demonstrations. Many wonder if the dire economic situation will spark street protests.
I don't think the American people get it. Because they would be out there, you know, as much as we're out there protesting for Black Lives Matter, they might also be protesting for that, for these economic decisions that are truly against the people.
Joe Biden is the new president, but the longtime elite politician has already helped preside over a five-decade failure of right-wing economic policies. Top media are openly asking, can Biden succeed where Obama failed? During Barack Obama's first 2 years, Democrats also controlled both houses of Congress and even had a filibuster-proof 60-vote majority in the Senate. Despite the urgencies created by the 2008 economic crisis, Democrats rejected progressive economic programs, and the crisis would later grow into what would be termed the Great Recession.
The Democrats, in their supposedly more progressive stance, I wouldn't say it is, but all they've got are these issues like gay marriage, some issues on racial equality and that sort of thing. But the true economic issues, they can't say anything to. And it's those true economic issues, really, that will lift us out of racism and that will lift us out of... That will create a fairer country.
The new economic data helped shock Wall Street into its worst daily drop since October. However, the S&P 500 stock market index gained $14 trillion in market value in 2020. That's caused many to say that stocks are no longer tied to market fundamentals, and warnings abound of another economic crisis provoked by high finance. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now, the head of the U.S. Capitol Police has called for measures to enhance security at the Capitol building following the January 6th attack there. The acting Capitol Police Chief urged lawmakers to add permanent fencing around the Capitol as part of those measures. Yogananda Pittman said backup forces should also be available in close proximity to the building. Meanwhile, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has spoken of what she called the enemy within the House. She said that raises the need for more funding.
I do believe, and I have said this all along, that we will probably need a supplemental for more security for members when the enemy is within the House of Representatives, a threat that members are concerned about in addition to what is happening outside.
Pelosi said there are members of Congress who want to bring guns on the floor. The calls for more security at Congress come as the Senate is preparing to hold an impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. The trial is set to be held next week. The House has charged Trump with inciting insurrection after his supporters stormed Congress earlier this month. They did so as lawmakers were certifying Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election. The Pentagon has reaffirmed its support to Taiwan's self-defense after China said independence for the island means war.
The department sees no reason why tensions over Taiwan need to lead to anything like confrontation. And so we find that comment unfortunate and certainly not commensurate with our intentions to meet our obligations under the Taiwan Relations Act.
The remarks were the first by President Joe Biden's military about China-Taiwan tensions. Since he took office last week, those tensions have been escalating in the past months as the U.S. increased support to Taiwan. The support included deals selling arms to the self-ruled island. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to U.S. support for it. China sees U.S. measures as a violation of the One China policy and interference in its internal affairs. Taiwan wants independence from China. The new U.S. administration has named a top advisor to former President Barack Obama as its special envoy for Iran. That's according to two State Department officials. Robert Malley was a key member of the Obama team that negotiated the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. He has taken the post at a time when tensions run high in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from the accord. The U.S. pulled out in 2018 under former President Donald Trump. The new administration says it will return to the deal, but first, Iran should go back to full compliance. On Thursday, Iran's ambassador to the UN urged the U.S. to act quickly to return to the agreement. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the window is closing on Tehran's deadline for Washington to lift its economic sanctions.
Swear.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden.
With the new U.S. administration taking the helm at the White House, many express optimism that the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will be back on the board. But comments by U.S. officials have raised doubts over the optimism. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will meet its commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, only after Tehran returns to full compliance with the JCPOA. Blinken said the U.S. wants to start meeting its obligations again, but Iran needs to act first. He said Washington would seek to build a longer and stronger accord to address what he called deeply problematic issues. He, however, noted that it will take a long time for the U.S. to return to the deal. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was quick to react, saying it is the United States that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. Zarif recalled it was Washington who violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicine to Iran, and punished countries which abided by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Therefore, it's the U.S. that should take the first step. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran as part of his so-called maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic. Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Tehran says it has lost trust in the Western members of the deal, and it will only revoke its measures after the U.S. removes its sanctions. On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov echoed a similar position, stressing that the United States must remove its sanctions against Iran and comply with the 2015 nuclear deal, as it was Washington that withdrew from the accord. Some experts say Biden has been a warmonger and is not going to return into a pacifist overnight.
I mean, the point being that virtually everything he has done has been imperialist. He's a chief warmonger for the U.S. government. He is not going to turn into a pacifist and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry.
With the Biden administration not showing any practical and real interest in returning to the deal, questions arise as whether he will follow in his predecessor's track and maintain his anti-Iran pressure campaign, or will it put an end to its malign policy against Tehran, as Iran foreign minister put it. Iran, on the other hand, says the window of opportunity is closing very fast.
The White House says it will review former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration's policy on Cuba. The White House spokesperson, Jen Psaki, said the support for democracy and human rights will be the core base for President Joe Biden's administration's Cuba strategy. After taking office in 2017, Trump took a tough stance against Havana, imposing sanctions on the country. Days before leaving office, Trump returned to the Caribbean country to the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, rolling back a detente reached during former President Barack Obama's tenure. Activist and political commentator Nicholas Ayala says the U.S. relations with Cuba have turned into a partisan matter.
Yeah, a lot of Republican lawmakers are still against this. I think part of it is because they
for the Republicans at least, it's more so a partisan issue where they're always going to be at odds with the Democratic lawmakers, but at the same time, it's an appeal to their base, because a lot of these folks are relying on that hardcore right-wing Cuban-American base, which is completely opposed to any sort of ties whatsoever against or any sort of opening up of the relations between U.S. and Cuba. And I think that's, again, that's, like you mentioned, it's sort of an old ideology coming from an old time, and I don't think that strategy is going to necessarily work for much longer. And I think that we're going to see that trend continue to shift more in that liberal way, where these Republicans who are using these outdated ideas and these outdated tactics of imperialism won't be able to last much longer in the political world, because these strategies simply aren't working. And it's going to take some serious push, but I think what we're seeing is newer generations of Cuban Americans who are attempting to build different strategies and actually want to open up to Cuba because they want to actually learn more about it for themselves.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou
harvest apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Ecuador is just weeks away from becoming the latest Latin American nation to move away from the IMF and United States and elect a strongly progressive anti-imperialist government. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "With the likely victory of Andres Arauz, Ecuador will join Latin America's anti-imperialist surge." Here's the details. According to reports, Ecuador is set to become the latest Latin American nation to move away from the United States and elect a strongly progressive anti-imperialist government. Successive public opinion studies have shown Andres Arauz of the Union por la Esperanza coalition holding a commanding lead over his rivals, with some suggesting he may receive double the votes of his nearest challenger. In 2018, Mexico voted in its first leftist president in decades. 1 year later, Argentina returned to progressive hands with the election of Alberto Fernandez. Perhaps most remarkably of all, Bolivians managed to turn back the U.S.-backed coup against Evo Morales last year, electing Morales' finance minister, Luis Arce, in October. Added to that are the failed attempts by the Trump administration to dislodge governments in Venezuela and Nicaragua. Meanwhile, far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is currently under fire from all sides for his handling of the COVID-19 crisis and has his popularity plunged. The youthful Arauz is an economist by trade and a disciple of Rafael Correa, president of Ecuador from 2007 to 2017, and the only Ecuadorian leader in modern history to be re-elected. Arauz is still only 35 years old, served as Minister of Knowledge and Human Talent at the tail end of the Correa administration, and initially wanted to select the former president as his running mate. However, Correa was banned from politics by a court presided over by his rival and current president, Lenin Moreno. He now lives in exile in Belgium, the country of his wife's birth. Correa is still a popular figure inside the country. He reduced poverty by 38% and extreme poverty by 47%, while doubling social spending, particularly in education, health, and housing. He was able to do this by defaulting on debt, ignoring mainstream economists' advice to keep taxes on the wealthy low and increasing the government's share of the country's oil revenues from 13% to 87%, much to the chagrin of foreign energy corporations. Correa was also part of a continent-wide move to the left, a wave of progressive anti-imperialist presidents elected in the time frame, a movement that included Lula da Silva in Brazil, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and Nestor Kirchner in Argentina. Under Corral's leadership, Ecuador expelled the United States military from the country, insisting they could only return if they granted his country a base in Florida. He also offered asylum to Western dissidents like Julian Assange. His vice president, Lenin Moreno, was elected in 2017 on a promise to carry on his legacy. Almost immediately, however, Moreno performed a 180-degree turn on policy, pulling Ecuador out of a number of regional alliances with other progressive anti-imperialist countries and renewing close ties to the U.S. It wasn't long before poverty and inequality in Ecuador began to rise, and Moreno was agreeing to substantial loans from the International Monetary Fund, IMF. Reversing Corral's oil policy and opening the country to foreign exploitation once more. At the same time as this was happening, the left appeared to be waning across the region. In 2016, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party was impeached, a chain of events that eventually led to Bolsonaro's rise. Meanwhile, conservative billionaire Sebastián Piñera won Chile's 2017 presidential election. Arauz has promised to reverse Moreno's spending cuts and cease business with the IMF. We don't see any sense in continuing with the current program the IMF had with the Moreno government, he told the Financial Times. Firstly, because the quantity of resources is too small, and secondly, because the conditionally associated with it is absolutely counterproductive for Ecuador's growth and development needs. Instead, Arauz will increase public spending to counter the negative effects of the pandemic, raise taxes on the wealthy, and increase capital controls on rich individuals taking their money out of the country. If foreign capital is necessary, he has stated he will negotiate with development banks in China. Ecuador was hit extremely hard by the coronavirus, in part because of Moreno's decision, encouraged by Washington, to expel around 400 Cuban doctors on the eve of the pandemic. Some opinion polls have found the current president's popularity to lie in the single digits. Economic issues are the primary concern for voters in this election, with 32% identifying poverty and 25% unemployment as their key concerns. Ecuador's poverty rate jumped from 25.7% in December 2019 to 58.2% in June 2020, with extreme poverty quadrupling over the same period. Most polls identify Arauz's closest challenger as Guillermo Lasso, a 65-year-old banker and former Coca-Cola executive popular with the country's wealthier class. An anti-communist, he was a member of the right-wing Christian group Opus Dei and came second in the 2017 presidential election, running on a new liberal platform. However, in recent weeks, Lasso has been fading, and some polls show 51-year-old indigenous leader Yaku Prez in second. Prez came to prominence in a nationwide protest against Moreno's austerity measures in 2019, but has also distanced himself from Cora and socialism. Arauz will win unless they steal it from him, wrote Professor Steve Elner, managing editor of the journal Latin American Perspectives. After all, Cora had a 60% favorable rating when he left office. Moreno is completely discredited, and Lasso has been around too long to be considered a new face for business in politics, and in addition is associated with global capital. However, a victory in Ecuador would underscore the dawning of a new era in the region. The United States calls it backyard.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Iraqi families lost 32 loved ones last Thursday in the Iraqi capital Baghdad after they woke up in the early morning to the impact of two deadly suicide bombings targeting a popular market in the city center. Tehran Square, where the twin terrorist attack took place, was seen to scores of dismembered bodies and hundreds of wounded victims. A day later, Daesh claimed responsibility for the attacks, saying they were aimed at Iraqi Shia Muslims. I wish someone would tell me how a psychotic Wahhabi Takfiri terrorist was able to tell the difference between a Sunni, a Shia, and a Christian Iraqi in the middle of the capital's open-air market. Hearing the story of how the terrorist attempted to gather as many victims around him as possible made my blood boil. The first suicide bomber blew himself up after pretending to be sick to gather people around him. The psycho fell to the ground and then detonated the vest after people rushed to help him. The second bomber detonated his explosive nearby just minutes later. The attack, which opened the door wide to many questions, came one day after the inauguration of Joe Biden as President of the United States. And immediately, hundreds of warmongering voices began calling for the U.S. occupation forces to remain in Iraq, get this, to repel the attacks of Daesh. So Daesh, which had been eliminated at the hands of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces in most of the areas it occupied, except the areas under U.S. control, only seemed to make a move when U.S. occupation troops attempt to leave the country. And despite the fact that U.S. occupation forces have been roaming freely in Iraq ever since they invaded the country in 2003, they sure seem unable to find Daesh to repel their attacks, which, by the way, have never once targeted the U.S. bases. However, they can easily spot all popular mobilization forces' bases and bomb them unequivocally, even when they cross over to Syria to fight off the remnants of Daesh. Meanwhile, in the wake of the terrorist attack, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi fired several senior national security officials of the country. These changes dominated the scene in Baghdad only a few hours before Daesh claimed responsibility of the attack, in a clear indication that al-Qadhimi is determined to restrict the security and military decisions to his own hands. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
twin suicide bombing on a bustling commercial street in the heart of Baghdad on Thursday killed at least 32 people and wounded more than 100. In an attack that ruptured months of relative calm, Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack, which bears the hallmarks of the terrorist organization who has carried out numerous similar attacks in Iraq. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. And it was evident that on the first day of Biden in office, we just saw renewed terrorism in Iraq, specifically in the capital, Baghdad, in the form of a twin terrorist suicide bombing attack where two Takfiri terrorists detonated themselves in a busy market. What are the indications of such an attack at such a timing?
Well, it's a clear indication that the United States is returning to the strategy of using these Wahhabi Contras to control both Iraq and Syria. So what happened, this suicide bombing that happened in Baghdad was followed also by attacks on the popular mobilization units, Iraqi army units that in Salah ad-Din, and that on the other side in Syria, attacks on the Syrian Arab army in Homs and Deir ez-Zor, all around the zones projecting from Al-Tanf occupied zone that straddles the border between Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, where the Americans are stationed, and across from Al-Shadadi in Hasaka, where the United States has these camps where they're holding ISIS fighters and their families. So we see a projection of ISIS attacks from those two zones into Syria desert and into Iraq, Salah ad-Din, as far as Baghdad also.
So basically, day after Biden takes office, just things go back to what the Obama administration used to maybe make it as a routine in Iraq.
Yes, definitely. And fortunately for the resistance and for the Arabic people in Iraq and Syria, this plan has already been defeated. There's nothing more that the United States can do through use of Wahhabi Contras as a tool of dominating the countries. Definitely there will be more deaths. You know, unfortunate, very sad. But it will be useless and unsuccessful as it was in its heydays in the early 2010s, you know, when...
Well, just a day later, we saw that Daesh took responsibility of the attack. And it is also appalling to me, by the way, that the world still speaks about Daesh as if they have a magic wand, that they can have the weapons that they want, they can get the funding that they need without looking to where this funding is coming from and where these weapons are coming from. The U.S. has so far failed miserably in relying on these groups, but what else can they bring to the Iraqi political scene if the only thing that they can do is actually terrorize the public?
Well, you know, obviously Saudi Arabia is the main funder. Behind them comes also Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Turkey of ISIS and other Wahhabi Contras. We know that, you know, of the more than 4,000 suicide bombings that were committed by ISIS in Iraq, the majority, the vast majority of them are committed by Saudi citizens. So that means also Saudi Arabia is the major producer of these suicide bombers from the Wahhabi Contras.
And it's so easy for a Saudi citizen to just cross over and kill himself and kill others with him?
Yes, I mean, the border is huge. It's a desert, the Syrian desert, that spreads from north Saudi-occupied Arabia into Iraq and Syria, and it's defended, this zone. So we have easy coming in and out of the country. Plus, obviously, they can be smuggled through Kurdistan and through Turkey also. So, but the main issue that we have right now is that for the first time yesterday, there was a attack on Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, on the King's Palace, the Yamama Palace in Riyadh, with the drones, and it was declared by a local Arabian resistance movement, a new one that declared that they were responsible and that they will be responding to any attacks on the peoples of Syria and Iraq with attacks on the regime of the Saud family.
Well, it was rather something new that had happened, which means that Saudi Arabia is now will be is under attack, actually under retaliatory attacks, and could be held responsible for everything that goes on in Iraq. But the increased security alert in Iraq and Syria, as you just mentioned, along with the increased Israeli aerial bombardment on both Iraqi-Syrian border and inside Syria, are said to be indications of the U.S.'s upcoming plan maybe to increase the numbers of its troops, both in Iraq and in Syria as well. What's your take on that specifically in Iraq, and how do you think that this will affect the general political scene in Iraq?
It's very volatile right now in Iraq, the political scene. You have, the parliament had already passed last year after the assassination of General Soleimani and Commander al-Muhandis. They passed a resolution calling for the immediate withdrawal of all foreign troops on Iraqi soil. The United States has, until now, ignored that, but now they're also going to go against it by adding more troops, as we hear Biden increasing the troops in Syria and Iraq. And at the same time, just after the suicide, the dual suicide bombing in Baghdad, there was, within 24 hours, 8 attacks on American logistical supply caravans that are bringing supplies to the American bases. So very soon right now, what will happen is that the American occupation soldiers will be almost held hostage within their bases. They will not be able to project their power outside the bases, and the only supply route for them will be an aerial supply route, which is a very dangerous technologically, and it's very dangerous to do that because you know the helicopters could be shot down by rockets. So the intensity of the confrontation is going to increase. The United States has to calculate, how many body bags is it willing to accept?
Mm-hmm. Well, all of what we just discussed brings us to a main responsibility held by the incumbent Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi, who fired actually several senior national security officials of the country just before actually Daesh took responsibility of the attack. So it was hours after the suicide attacks, the twin suicide attacks. Now his move was a clear indication that al-Qadhimi is determined to restrict the security and military decisions to his own hands inside of Iraq. Is that wise of him to actually maybe hold on to the decision-making process all by himself? I mean, especially that he has been provoking the only force capable of actually eliminating Daesh in Iraq, and that's the popular mobilization forces.
Well, we have to remember that al-Qadhimi was the head of the Iraqi Mukhabarat, the Iraqi intelligence services, and he was kind of the main link between the American authorities and the Iraqi government prior to his appointment as prime minister. So, we have to understand what's happening right now is that he did fire most of the security apparatus leaders after the suicide bombings, claiming that their failures to stop those suicide bombings somebody needs to be held responsible for it, and therefore he fired all these people. It is a dangerous situation. As you said, there's now concentration of power within al-Qadhimi himself, and we have seen right now the PMU speak openly out against the presence of American troops, mm-hmm. and the attacks on them. So we have a dangerous situation where al-Qadhimi may reveal himself as more of an agent of the United States, but many people in Iraq will have to deal with that.
Well, that is surely to be seen in the upcoming weeks. I want to thank you very much, Laith Maabouf, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the latest developments in Iraq. Please stay tuned. We will next talk about Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
As the U.S. continues to occupy parts of Syria in a clear violation of the territorial integrity of the Arab country, an Apache attack helicopter belonging to the U.S. military has reportedly crashed in Syria's northeastern province of Hasakeh, with no information available about the fate of those on board the helicopter. The initial deployment of U.S. occupation soldiers to that specific area was meant to plunder the country's crude oil resources. However, now it seems someone is making sure that the U.S. abandons their theft efforts. U.S. Apache down in Syria in this following report.
A Boeing AH-64 Apache attack helicopter belonging to the U.S. military reportedly crashed on the morning of Tuesday, January 19, in Syria's northeastern province of Hasakeh, with no information available about the fate of those on board. The Arabic service of Russia Sputnik News Agency, citing local sources, reported that the aircraft went down inside a U.S.-run base at the Al-Jabsa oil field in the oil-rich city of Al-Shaddadi, located about 60 kilometers south of the provincial capital city of Hasakeh. The sources claimed the helicopter crashed during a refueling operation and that there were reports of injuries among its crew members. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. The U.S. first confirmed its looting of Syrian oil during a Senate hearing exchange between South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in late July last year. On July 30, and during his testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Pompeo confirmed for the first time that an American oil company would begin work in northeastern Syria, which is controlled by Kurdish militants from the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF. The Syrian government strongly condemned the agreement, saying that the deal was struck to plunder the country's natural resources, including oil and gas, under the sponsorship and support of the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Separately, the U.S. military reportedly transported dozens of Daesh terrorists from prisons run by allied Kurdish militants in northeastern Syria to Al-Tanf military base in southern Syria near the Jordanian border. That is the same Tanf area that Israel and the U.S. usually target to stop the advancement of the Syrian Arab Army, the only legitimate force that actually eliminated Daesh in more than 70% of Syria.
Now, with us from Damascus is Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist, to talk to us about what is happening inside Syria, the occupied territories of Syria by the U.S. occupation. Thank you for being with us, Vanessa. Now, when a U.S. Apache helicopter is said to have crashed in Syria's northeastern province of Hasakeh near the Al-Jabsa oil field, where U.S. occupation forces have been plundering Syrian crude oil, would that still make it an accident?
Well, as far as I know, we don't have any update on the reasons behind that crash, and I don't think there has been any official statement that I'm aware of either from Syrian military or from the Americans. So I think, you know, I think we have to assume for now that it was an accident until we hear otherwise, particularly from the Syrian military. If it was brought down by Syrian military, they are normally pretty quick to put out a statement taking responsibility, but we don't have any such statement.
Well, but that also means that someone, some group of some form from Hasakeh might actually be beginning some sort of a resistance against the occupiers. Could that be an actual scenario in the upcoming weeks?
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. We've seen quite a number of videos coming out of the region showing local and tribal members basically resisting the U.S. illegal occupation of that area. And, of course, a recent, I think it was a Reuters or an AP photograph showing a local child sort of digging through the rubbish surrounding the oil fields, trying to find food to eat, while in the background, the Kurdish Contras, under the direction of the U.S. occupation, U.S. coalition occupation forces, are, as you say, plundering Syria of its oil resources via the Delta Crescent Energy oil company, which was allowed to enter Syria under the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. occupation reportedly transported also dozens of Daesh terrorists from prisons run by their allied Kurdish Contras in northeastern Syria to El Tanf military base in southern Syria, which is near the Jordanian border. Now, that is in that same area, the U.S. and Israel have been bombing any sort of advancement for the Syrian Arab Army or its allies. They are not allowing them to go and liberate the area. What is the U.S. planning to do with those terrorists in that specific area?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, not only is the U.S. transporting ISIS fighters to Al Tanf, but they are also transporting them across the border into Iraq, where they are being retrained and re-equipped into a kind of super ISIS, which is then being percolated back into northeastern Syria. And of course, recently we've seen a spate of attacks by ISIS against Syrian Arab Army convoys on the road to Deir ez-Zor, including one yesterday, which left three Syrian Arab Army martyred and 10 wounded. Air cover was then given to the convoy, which allowed it to arrive safely at Deir ez-Zor. But in Al Tanf itself, of course, we shouldn't forget that there is a 55-kilometer exclusion zone around Al Tanf military base. Mm-hmm. The Al-Walid crossing into Iraq is what is being used to transport the stolen oil into Iraq for trading. And, of course, that trading revenue is sustaining the proxies on the ground inside Syria, previously ISIS and now, of course, the Kurdish Contras. But also what is important to understand is that in that 55-kilometer exclusion zone around Al Tanf, there are ongoing military exercises overseen by the U.S. occupation troops using equipment such as HIMARS, the High Mobility Artillery Units, that have a maximum range of 300 kilometers. This puts them with potential to target the outskirts of Damascus.
Wow.
So terrorists are being given equipment which can effectively be used against, as you rightly stated, Syrian Arab Army, Russian positions, allied positions, but can also be used to target civilian infrastructure in the future if there is an escalation, and we see very strong signs of an escalation under the Joe Biden administration.
Vanessa, what I want to talk about is that Syria has actually issued its first message to the new U.S. President Joe Biden, urging the incoming U.S. leader to withdraw troops from the war-torn nation and to abandon efforts to tap into the country's oil reserves. How do you think the new administration will receive that?
Well, I mean, I think it's very convenient that we've seen almost immediately surrounding Biden's inauguration, we saw an ISIS attack in Baghdad. We've seen, as I said, an increase in ISIS attacks on the ground in northeastern Syria and stretching towards northeastern Aleppo and towards Homs. And so, of course, if we remember back to 2018, December, when Trump said he was going to withdraw the troops, almost immediately there was an ISIS attack on Manbij, which killed four American operatives, potential intelligence operatives, and injured three others. And so, therefore, the plans to remove or withdraw troops were scotched. And now, of course, with the Biden incoming administration and that administration consisting of, let's say, Bush, Obama, Clinton, era war hawks and neoconservatives, we know that there is very likely to be an increase of American military footprint in Syria. And we've seen that in the last few days. We've seen military convoys, U.S. military convoys entering northeast Syria with hardware and weapons, heading for the region around the oil fields, which of course is occupied by U.S. coalition troops and proxies.
That raises a lot of flags, Vanessa, concerning that when you said in the Trump administration, when Trump wanted to remove the soldiers, the people who are controlling ISIS, which, as you said, are within the current administration and the former Obama administration, were actually sending messages against their own soldiers by targeting them to make them remain as an occupation inside Syria. That's a very dangerous issue. But yet again, Biden has not set any clear strategy for Syria, but his campaign has sought to distance itself from the Trump approach. Yet Biden also never commented on the continuous Israeli aggression against the Syrian Arab Army, specifically lately against civilians in Hama. Do you think that Israel can still maintain an open aggressive policy against Syria now that Trump is no longer there?
Well, let's also not forget that the U.S. itself, I think it was just prior to the inauguration of Joe Biden, targeted Iraqi army positions inside Iraq and PMU positions. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that you know, what we're seeing since New Year's Eve, in reality, which I guess was kind of the handover period, the vacuum period between Trump leaving and Biden coming in, we've seen, as you said, an increase in Israeli attacks leading to, a couple of days ago, an attack at 4 a.m. in the morning, which targeted multiple areas in Syria, including, as you rightly say, a little village, Kazoo, to the west of Hama, where four civilian homes were destroyed and a family of four was martyred and tens of others were injured. I'll actually be visiting that area in the next few days.
We are out of time. I want to thank Vanessa Beely, independent journalist, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the latest developments in the occupied territories by the U.S. occupation in Syria. Thank you, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.